industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Dr. Vora is board-certified clinical toxicologist, consultant, and senior academic director of the Michigan Poison and Drug Information Center, and associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit, Michigan.
All right, thanks, Dr. Blumenberg. All right, everyone, let's jump into the history of bromides. All right, I have no disclosures. Objectives, I'm going to be describing the history of bromides and their use origins. So being a tox history talk, obviously, I'm going to focus mainly on the history of this topic and this substance, but I'll touch on some historical and current bromide sources, some pharmacology and toxicology, and some clinical management of bromism. So to call a story or a statement of bromide, which became a popular slight in the late 1800s, was to dismiss it because it actually had been repeated so frequently that it became meaningless. So the term bromide itself is embedded in our lexicon. And bromides state the obvious, they have a dulling effect, like a sedative per se. So they can feel boring or they can dull the impact of a conversation. And I'm sure we've all heard some before. So the origin of the term was actually inspired by almost universal use of bromide of potassium in the mid to late 1800s. And the history of the drug has been recounted for nearly 200 years. And the story itself has become a bit of a bromide because it lacks historical context. So a lot of this talk will be based on examining and retelling the history of bromides that adds context to its beginnings and its place in the scientific, medical, and cultural world at the time. So as with a lot of history, you might hear differing accounts. I'm first going to talk or discuss a popular version about the bromide origin story that centers around a specific individual. And I'm going to do a little myth busting and dig deeper and pull back the curtain. So bromide of potassium or potassium bromide or bromides, I'll use these interchangeably, was first compounded and introduced as a medical remedy in Europe. And the effects included muscle relaxation, sedation, lethargy, or deep sleep. And after the mid-19th century, bromides became known as the first pharmaceutical with reported benefits in epileptics. But it had a long place beforehand to connection to epilepsy and was a favored OTC for the public. So first, let's start with the typical story version that you might encounter. So here's Sir Charles Lockock, an obstetrician and gynecologist to Queen Victoria. And he was the president of the British Royal Medical Society, who in May of 1857, he headed a society meeting that featured a paper presented by a neurologist, Edward Siefking. So the neurologist actually reported his observations of 52 epileptic patients, but at no point did he mention bromides. So the story goes that Lockock described his experience with cases of hysterical epileptic patients and his successful use of bromides to treat their seizures. So Lockock reportedly read about a German scientist who took 10 grains of potassium bromide 3 times daily and became sexually impotent. So Lockock applied the rationale that this could be useful for the convulsions in his female patients diagnosed with hysteria. Believing that hyperexcitability of female genitals was one underlying cause of epilepsy. And now the neurologist published his findings in The Lancet, including Lockock's commentary, and bromide was acknowledged as the first effective anti-epileptic drug. So now this version of the story counts Lockock as the founding father of anti-epileptic treatment and the first to showcase the novelty and therapeutic effects of bromides for epilepsy. And this version was spread in journals and texts with proponents citing Lockock's clinical skills and his intuition. And now Victorians were apparently really concerned with sexual matters, specifically with masturbation as a cause of both epilepsy and mental illness. So storytellers speculate on the role of what is always we know now as an erroneous association in Lockock's alleged discovery process. So now let's actually pull back the curtain. So the historical development of bromides begins, of course, with bromine, which occurs naturally in salt springs and seawater. Now, European chemists had actually isolated bromine in the 1820s, but none had actually capitalized on its historical significance. Now, it wasn't until 1826 with Antoine Ballard, a 23-year-old French chemist studying pharmacy, and he was studying the iodine content in seaweed and brine. So he treated samples with chlorine water, and what he found was a yellowish-orange layer floating on top. So he distilled that fluid and found a deep red pungent substance, and he was convinced he was dealing with a new element similar to chlorine and iodine. So Ballard published his findings and named the new element muriate from the Latin muriaticus relating to brine or salt, and France's Science Academy was impressed, but wanted to rename the substance brome, which came from the Greek for strong or pungent odor. So once Ballard published his findings, other chemists started experimenting with bromine. And other than mercury, bromine was the only element that remained liquid at room temperature. And European physicians and pharmacists began to study bromine's potential medical applications. Now, in contrast to the original story of bromide's emergence in the 1850s, the reality was that physicians and pharmacists incorporated bromides into practices and treatments dating back to the 1830s, because they didn't view bromide as entirely new, because bromine was seen as sharing similar properties with chlorine and iodine, which were already widely used in medicines. So now 2 months after Ballard's publication, The Lancet published his findings in English, and discussed bromine's similarities to chlorine and iodine. And then the Edinburgh Journal of Science in 1827 reinforced that bromates were analogous to the chlorates and iodates, with instructions on actually how to isolate bromine from medical for medicinal remedies. So bromine itself was too corrosive to be ingested on its own, but as a salt formulation paired with an element like, say, potassium, it was more tolerable. So French physician François Magendie began experimenting with bromine after learning about Ballard's results. And he concluded that bromide compounds were indicated where iodine was not working adequately enough. Now, bromides began to appear more frequently in respected texts, like the London Pharmacopoeia, that described its use for splenomegaly. Now, by the 1840s, bromides were well known and used frequently in Europe for syphilis, ulcers, skin inflammation, and other inflammatory processes. And these were all ailments that were traditionally treated with iodides. Now, these published recommendations show common use of bromides before the 1850s, well in advance of Lockock's testimonial in 1857. So after the 1850s, clinical experience changed the conception and use of bromides to more of a sedative. So Alfred Garrod included an entry on bromides in his 1855 Materia Medica and highlighted the powerful sedative effects of bromides over the iodide compounds. Now, experimenters were appreciating the dose-response relationships, especially when it came to sedation. And according to the thesis of Jean-Baptiste Reims, bromides could maintain a chronic state of lethargy, which he called irasponerique or bromidic intoxication. And this is where our earlier friend Charles Lockock, the supposed founding father of bromides, this is where he enters this story version. So he treated female patients with symptoms attributed to hysteria, from Greek for uterus, and it was thought that mental disturbances in women were due to a wandering womb or hyperexcitability associated with menstruation and masturbation. So Lockock's decision to use bromides on these patients was based on their sedative effects. So at the Royal Medical Society meeting of 1857 that I mentioned from the outset, in response to the neurologist discussing his observations of his epileptic patients, Lockock brought up that sexual excitement was not raised as a cause of epileptic fits and shared his observations about his success using bromides in the cases of hysteria. So since Lockock had read earlier about bromide's association with impotency and with the theory that sexual excitement was an underlying cause of epileptic convulsions, he extrapolated the concept that bromides would be effective in suppressing the nervous system. So he leveraged the bromides as a nervous system depressant and not as an anti-epileptic agent. So one could plausibly argue that Lockock neither discovered bromides, nor was he actually treating epilepsy. So London neurologist Radcliffe cautiously recommended bromides in his text and credited Lockock specifically for bringing bromides to the attention of neurologists. Now, Radcliffe encouraged general practitioners and neurologists to use bromides generally for convulsive disorders, which historians believe boosted more widespread bromide use clinically. And the important distinction here, though, is that Radcliffe proposed bromides acting on convulsions as a whole, whereas Lockock claimed that by suppressing sexual urges with a bromide nerve depressant, he was addressing the hysterical symptoms. He didn't actually make any statements on treating seizures, which he chalked up to as symptomatic of the hysteria. So now, as bromides gained more attention, they became really popular because of their association with helping people sleep and being known as sort of a true hypnotic. And in 19th century medicine, physicians often discussed the self-limited course of most diseases and the supremacy of nature's healing powers. And many believe that drugs that claim to act on a specific disease was quackery. So more physicians concluded that if nature was left alone to do its work, the disease would run its course and the patient would ultimately recover. Now, sleep was associated with a natural and healthy physiological state. So bromide's association with sleep alleviated a lot of concern with the perception that they induced a quote unquote natural state of sleep. Now, household medicines and self-treatment were cornerstones of medical care back then, so bromides became a favored therapy. Now, bromides entered the public consciousness, like this piece by the New York Times, which compared the hypnotics available to the public. And bromides were touted for producing a restorative sleep, and that the sleep state was more effective and higher quality compared to opium products, which were addictive and came with nasty side effects like these hallucinations. Now, the New York Times piece tapped into a key feature of bromides in addressing a very common cultural ailment at the time, which was nervousness. So patients increasingly used bromides for relief from worries and pressures, and physicians and pharmacists issued bromides for low-level chronic nervousness. And association of bromides with the relief of nerves, which range from anywhere from self-doubt to worry, anxiety, all things that we feel, led to greater use and commercial availability. But there was a faction of the medical establishment that viewed widespread bromide use as a fad, and that drugs with universal actions were misguided. So the criticisms continued into the late 1800s, but bromide use continued to increase because of the perception that it induced a natural sleep, a state that allowed the body to heal itself. Now, despite the perception that it worked similarly in everybody, in reality, bromides produced a variety of reactions. So the American Journal of Insanity published a report about an informal trial of bromides on asylum patients, with patients experiencing adverse reactions, and one patient actually died. Now, Victor Bazier explained that large doses of the drug cause tremors, diminished reflexes, and in general, a slowing of movement and thought. And he termed this state of extreme lethargy as bromism. That could be accompanied by psychosis. So by the 1880s, the adverse effects of bromides were clear, but many physicians still held on to the perceived therapeutic benefits. Now, physician and director of the Craig Colony for Epileptics, it was the US's first public institution for people with epilepsy, supported bromide's place in therapy, but he did note the growing cases of severe bromism. Now, bromides continued as the primary treatment for epileptic seizures into the 1900s until phenobarb was introduced in 1912, and eventually bromides became obsolete for seizures when phenytoin arrived in 1938. But bromides continued to be a favored remedy by the public, and it was very accessible. So drug regulation was very limited before the 1930s because legislation focused mainly on pharmaceutical purity and didn't really focus on restricting access. So people continued self-prescribing and using bromides for various ailments. Now, but bromism cases piled up. So more patients were being admitted for delirium. Psychiatrists in the early 1900s reconceptualized the drug as a harmful, not helpful substance. And the attitude around bromides changed with texts cautioning bromide use as a sedative to manage agitation, only as a short-term and last resort, but ultimately concluded that they caused more harm. And by 1929, mention of bromides as a therapeutic in clinical texts were largely removed, and the only discussion was of adverse neuropsychiatric effects. In the 1930s and 40s, bromism was recognized as a frequent cause of altered mental status, psychiatric complaints, and even coma. So by the 1940s, the US FDA was focused on illegal sales of other or newer addictive substances like amphetamines, but bromides remained popular with the public as OTC sleep aids and headache remedies. In 1938, bromide sales in the US were second only to aspirin. In 1975, though, scientists reported to the FDA that Americans spent nearly $60 million on non-prescription sedatives, a lot of which were bromide-based, and recommended that they only be available with a prescription. So by 1989, the FDA removed organic bromides entirely from sleep aids. So there were multiple medicinal sources of bromide in the 1800s and the early 1900s, and several medications today, as we know, exist as bromide salts, but their intended clinical effects are unrelated to the bromide ion. So bromide is present in trivial amounts, and the therapeutic dosing doesn't lead to bromide toxicity in these products. But certain meds like dextromethorphan, as we know, are chronically abused, and bromism can theoretically occur. And acute overdoses of modern products with these bromide salts are usually associated with GI symptoms, and large acute overdoses rarely produce systemic toxicity. Bromism, though, is more synonymous with the chronic repeated exposures over weeks and months. And hallmarks of toxicity are those neuropsychiatric effects. You have CNS depression, which can range from lethargy, ataxia, dysarthria, even coma, obviously, in severe cases. And the psychiatric disturbances can vary, so they can be hallucinations or delusions to full-blown psychosis. Now, another feature is bromoderma, which is an actiform rash with pustular lesions and ulcers. And these can form without the neuropsychiatric effects. And it's believed to be a hypersensitivity type reaction, as well as due to chronic accumulation of the bromides, with symptoms lasting weeks to months. And this was a case presented in the New England Journal of a 63-year-old man with ulcerated erythematous nodules on his hands and fingers. So it turns out he was drinking 8 liters of Ruby Red Squirt daily for several months. And he was treated with colchicine as an antineutrophilic, with symptoms resolving after 4 months. And this turns out the soft drink had brominated vegetable oil, or BVO, which was an emulsifier and flavor carrier commonly added to citrus flavor drinks, but what is now banned as of 2024. So bromide salts have nearly 100% bioavailability when ingested, so they're predominantly renally eliminated with a half-life of about 12 days. So chronic exposure can lead to accumulation, which significantly impacts chloride and increases renal elimination of chloride since the renal tubules tend to reabsorb bromide. And this depletes total body chloride stores and changes in chloride distribution. This impacts cell conductance, which are thought to be the underlying cause of the neuropsychiatric symptoms of bromism. Now, remember, bromide is very similar in properties to chloride, so it can interfere with lab testing and produce a pseudohypercholuremia and a low anion gap. Now, the widely accepted mechanism of bromides are the indirect effects on the GABA receptor. And as we all know, binding of GABA to GABA-A receptor increases chloride conductance and hyperpolarization ensues. But bromide has a smaller diameter than chloride and more easily diffuses through the channel, which increases the inhibitory effects and explains a lot of the GABAergic symptoms associated with bromism, like the CNS depression. Now, of course, first identifying and removing the bromide source is going to be paramount. The first-line treatment for this, it will be a chloride load, so chloride concentrations can be restored and to increase the bromide clearance with aggressive fluid hydration using normal saline. And this reduces the bromide half-life down from 12 days to about 3 days. And IV fluid hydration should usually be sufficient, but there have been cases where diuretics have been used. And in severe cases where patients who can't tolerate sodium or fluids like CHF or renal failure patients, dialysis can be an option and cuts the bromide half-life down to a couple of hours. But serum bromide concentrations can rebound after aggressive elimination with redistribution. So bromoderma typically is treated with topical or oral steroids or even colchicine from the New England Journal case, but there's no strong evidence for these treatments. So priority should be increasing the clearance of the bromides with the chloride load or dialysis. So in 2007, there was an outbreak of a neurological disease in Angola, where about 500 people exhibited various symptoms, including trouble walking and talking, weakness, dizziness, and blurred vision. And after investigation, many of the patients actually had significantly elevated bromide concentrations. And it turns out that the local dietary salt supply was found to have a large amount of sodium bromide. So if this confirmed, this would be the largest ever outbreak of bromide poisoning and bromism. And you'll still see this pop up in modernity, like the case from just this year, a bromism of a 60-year-old. Male who consulted AI on the dangers of salt and had to remove chloride from his diet. And what he came up with as an alternative, he used a bunch of sodium bromide for 3 months and presented with the hallmark bromism symptoms with the neuropsychiatric effects and the bromoderma. So I'll end on this note. Since the early to mid 1800s, bromides went through multiple conceptual transformations and its use went basically unabated for a good 50-year period. And the promise of natural sleep accounted for a lot of bromide's popularity. And the reluctance to give up on its perceived benefits meant bromide use was uninterrupted. But by the early 1900s, bromides were so overused that they accounted for over a third of all prescriptions, according to 1920s and 1930s British private practice data. So I suppose the term itself found a fitting place in the vernacular as a synonym for something so commonplace. So I appreciate your attention with my somewhat new bromide story, and hopefully that didn't feel bromidic. And these are my references. And I appreciate everyone's attention. Thank you.